John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, October 25th, 2011. The Israeli army demolishes a family's house and olive trees, and Tel Aviv confirms plans to create thousands of new settlement units south of Jerusalem. These stories and more coming up, so stay tuned. The Israeli army has demolished a 120 square meter house and uprooted many trees in the village of Anata, in the northeastern part of East Jerusalem on Tuesday. A large military force invaded the village, followed by jeeps and bulldozers, who demolished the house and uprooted several olive trees. Army personnel claimed that the house was built without a construction permit, documentation which is nigh on impossible to obtain. In other incursions into the West Bank, the Israeli army arrested 10 Palestinians in a series of raids. Soldiers entered several areas of the West Bank cities of Nablus, Ramallah, Hebron, and arrested 9 men, with the 10th being taken from the village of Salamana near the city of Bethlehem. Ahmed Rabi, 29, was killed this Tuesday morning when his tunnel collapsed upon him. Medical sources claimed that the rescue operation took several hours to locate his body and confirmed that he was the only person inside the tunnel. The tunnel was located in the Al-Barazil neighbourhood, just east of the Rafah crossing with Egypt. While the exact cause of the collapse is unknown, nearly 200 Palestinians, including 10 children, have been killed in collapsing tunnels since 2006. In the worst of these incidents, the Israeli army bombarded the tunnels in an attempt to destroy them. Unfortunately, people were still in the tunnels at the time and 20 people were killed. The Israeli authorities have prevented Awad Yunus al-Wagub, 60, from travelling to the Gaza Strip to meet his son, who was released in the first phase of the prisoner swap deal and exiled to Gaza. He claims that there is no reason for this, and that he has been denied seeing his son for nearly a decade, and that Israel is merely placing obstacles in the way of the families of released detainees to ruin their happiness. He has appealed to human rights groups to intervene and secure him passage to travel to the Gaza Strip to see his son. Israeli media sources reported that the Israeli government recently approved a new plan to construct a settlement neighbourhood called Givat Halmatos near Beit Safafa, south of Jerusalem. Israeli media reported that the new neighbourhood will be built in three stages to construct 4,000 units for Jewish settlers. They added that the implementation of the new project in the southern part of Jerusalem will help complete the Jerusalem Belt by completely surrounding the city with settlements and creating a link between Gilo Settlement and Har Humah. developments that will eventually seal the southern entrance of Jerusalem. That's all for today from IMEMC. This was the Tuesday, October 25th, daily roundup of news from occupied Palestinian territories. We hope you will join us again tomorrow. This has been brought to you by Hussam Qassis and me, William Gibson.
Afghanistan, Saturday. The U.S. military is reporting the deaths of three soldiers from an IED in Kandahar. Afghanistan, Saturday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Sunday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Sunday. A Polish soldier was killed in a roadside bombing in Ghazni province, and a second soldier was wounded in the attack. Afghanistan, Monday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, yesterday. A U.S. helicopter has been damaged following a militant attack in central Afghanistan, Press TV reports. According to a statement released by NATO headquarters in Afghanistan, the helicopter sustained damage after it was hit twice by Taliban militants in Alisei district in the central province of Kapisa Monday afternoon. Following the attack, the chopper was forced to land at a nearby base, but none of its crew suffered injuries. Afghanistan, last Friday. At least 13 Afghan civilians were injured after a U.S.-led airstrike targeting suspected Taliban militants hit a house in Afghanistan's northeastern province of Kunar. The NATO-led International Security Assistance Force issued a statement on Friday and confirmed the incident, Reuters reported. The assault came after U.S.-led foreign forces returned fire following an attack by resistance fighters. When news reports say someone was injured, that can mean anything from a bullet wound to an amputation or someone getting their face burned off, the reports never seem to say. Pakistan, last week, an oil company was warned by insurgents to cut off deliveries to the army or else. Iraqi Kurdistan, today. Turkish tanks and armored vehicles crossed into northern Iraq in the direction of a Kurdish Workers' Party or PKK camp. The armored column, with hundreds of troops, was moving towards a militant camp at Paftanin, about 20 miles from the Habar border post and near the Iraqi city of Zako, the sources reported. Several hundred PKK fighters were believed to be based at Haftanin, the sources said. Warplanes took off earlier from bases in Diyarbakir and Malatya to launch airstrikes on the camp as the latest phase of operations began Monday afternoon. Baghdad, today. A roadside bomb targeting a traffic police patrol went off in the Yura district of northeastern Baghdad, killing a traffic policeman and wounding three other people, including another policeman, according to police and hospital sources. Baghdad, today. A roadside bomb targeting a traffic police patrol blew up and wounded four people, including a traffic policeman, in the Zafarniya district of southeastern Baghdad. Baghdad, today. Sticky bomb or magnetic bomb attached to a traffic police vehicle went off and wounded five people, including two policemen, in the Baladet district of eastern Baghdad. Baghdad, Iraq, yesterday. At least five bombings were reported in the city, killing at least six people and wounding at least 25. One was a suicide car bomb. Washington, today. Stop the machine. Now occupying Freedom Plaza with a permit sort of like the one U.S. troops have in Iraq, has posted the 3 p.m. time of a hearing of the House Armed Forces Committee in Rayburn 2212 as a target for protests and disruption. Prior such eruptions following the Code Pink model have led to arrests and massive disruption. The protests will point out the folly of spending hundreds of billions on war while the economy collapses. Iraq, ongoing. U.S. President Barack Obama has announced that U.S. forces are throwing in the towel after 8 years of war, but only in Iraq, not in Afghanistan. All U.S. troops now occupying Iraq are supposed to be home for the holidays, ending 8 years of futile war that has changed nothing. The U.S. troops have had little impact on the course of the multifaceted war in Iraq except for being a recruiting poster for more fighters and more attacks. In 2 months, that will finally end. Even some Shiite groups in Iraq are now saying Al-Qaeda in Iraq will have no further excuse for attacks on them once the U.S. troops are gone. Mr. Barack Obama, now's the time to do the same thing in Afghanistan. Throw in the towel, bring all the troops home today.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com.
As the activists in New York City's Zuccotti Park were gearing up to celebrate the one-month anniversary of their Occupy Wall Street encampment, the ripple effects of what started out as a modest protest of several hundred people was blossoming into what is increasingly being recognized as a powerful worldwide movement. Your reporter visited the New York protest site and spoke with Jeff Smith, an Occupy Wall Street activist who has been at Zuccotti Park from the first day of the encampment on September 17th. He talks about the rapidly expanding economic justice movement and how it may relate to U.S. electoral politics.
Well, I think, you know, in America, there's so much pain that's been percolating just under the surface. And what I think this movement was able to do is gain some traction and basically is a catalyst for, you know, so much emotion that's been ready to come out. And so really the hardest part, at least in this country, is getting that foothold, getting the start of something that people will pay attention to and that other people want to come together around. And so the strategy in making this a permanent occupation and essentially not going away or telling the media and the public we're not going away was the first step in creating that traction. And although plenty of the media ignored us to begin with, and subsequent to that, they started to belittle us and mock us, and the coverage has definitely changed. At this point now, as it's grown in popularity, we're starting to get some real coverage, and it grows even more. But I think all along, the public understood exactly what this is about. And when we say it's Occupy Wall Street, it's about the financial power in this country and the fact that even more so than Washington, D.C., this is where decisions are made in this country.
As far as the corporate media focus, almost their sole focus for many weeks now has been, where's your list of demands? Where's your clarity? Where's a convenient slogan that we can pigeonhole you guys as to what you're about? I wonder if you would tell us, what's your impression of the pros and cons of what looks to be building a grassroots movement from the bottom up as opposed to some hierarchical structure where some, you know, activists in a back office hand down a list of demands to everybody else? What are the pros and cons with that, you think?
Well, I think in a lot of cases, you know, what may be described as our weaknesses and our strengths are really the same. And so by not having a hierarchical structure and specific messaging and a list of demands, the corporate media doesn't know how to cover this or approach it. And we know that if we gave them a list, who would acknowledge it anyway? I mean, they just want that so that they can tear us down, and that's understood. So rather than playing their game, I think we maintain a sort of transparency and, you know, anti-strategy when it comes to messaging that goes straight through to the public, and I think that's why it's effective. And I think everything that we're doing here is about representing. I mean, Gandhi says that the means are parallel to the end. So really what we're establishing here in every way, I think, mirrors the society as we'd like to see it change. And the fact that the corporate media can't cover that story or can't understand that is sort of indicative of the fact that all of our hierarchical structures no longer represent the vast public. And so when people come here and they experience this firsthand, I think they get it immediately, and it resonates in a way that is both obtuse to the corporate media, but also, you know, goes around them in a way that is finally feeling like the truth is winning out over, you know, messaging and propaganda. And usually it's not even about who's right or who's got the best facts. It's about who positions the message the best, and that's who wins. And I think it's really edifying to this movement, the fact that the truth does seem to be, you know, winning out, and the public does seem to get this.
Just the last question. When a lot of flawed comparisons are made to the Tea Party about what's going on here in Zuccotti right. Park and across the country, there's some focus on electoral politics and what this is going to mean, you know, in terms of the next election, which is an important election.
Right.
What do you see the impact of this Occupy Wall Street movement on electoral politics in terms of, you know, changing the subject, changing the topic of debate and the direction of the debate, or something more tangible in terms of pressuring candidates to do X, Y, Z?
I mean, it's been described that this is sort of the answer to the Tea Party on the left. I think it's probably more appropriate. I think Naomi Klein that said that it's really, this is the answer to the Democratic Party. And I think there's no misgivings that both corporate parties are really on the outside of what's going on here, which is not to say that there aren't people here that may vote for Obama as opposed to the candidate. And I don't know that we can pretend to say that this is going to change politics within the next election cycle, but I think that it's completely off message to say that we want to channel this towards any specific electoral party. I think that's been done in the past, and frankly that's the failings of other grassroots efforts, is that by the time you channel it into the status quo, they can control it and take it over. And part of what's great about this is that no one can take over this. And even when it's been talk about Democratic groups or union groups or any kind of hierarchical structures wanting to co-opt this, the fundamental nature of this structure doesn't allow for it. And so I think ultimately this is about replacing the current system of electoral politics with something that actually works. And I think it's sort of pointless to talk about, you know, its effects on the existing structure.
That was Jeff Smith, an Occupy Wall Street activist who has been at Zuccotti Park from the first day of the encampment on September 17th. Find more links to analysis and commentary on the Occupy Wall Street movement on our website at btlonline.org.
20th of October, Stop the Machine shuts down Citibank, closes 20 accounts.
Yeah, you got a situation.
What did Stop the Machine do today at Citibank?
We went in there, occupied, took over the controlling bank, asked for our money back, asked for them to stop foreclosing, told them that they needed to give us our bailout money back, and basically shut down business for the day.
And did they close up?
Yes, they did.
And which branch was this?
This is a branch of 14th and G, 14th, Northeast,
14th
Northwest.
And G Northwest. And how many people were trying to close their accounts?
I would say upwards of 20 people.
Not bad.
Unions. This is a corrupt enterprise. You're underpaid. Your executive gets paid $9 million. What do you get paid a year? What do you get paid a year?
Conducting business.
What do you get paid a year? They pay their tellers $12.65 an hour while the executives make $9 million. You're getting ripped off here. This place is unfair to workers. This place is unfair to the country. They're foreclosing on people despite making record profits. They're putting people in the street. This is a criminal enterprise, this place. You guys are a part of a criminal enterprise. You know, the tellers get paid so little here. You guys are being mistreated, by the way. You're all being mistreated by the executives here who make $9 million a year. You guys make minimum wage. It's unacceptable. This is the appropriate place. It's a criminal enterprise.
Sir, I need
it's a criminal
to
enterprise.
Sir, I need you.
It's
to
a criminal
leave.
Enterprise here.
Sir, I do.
This place is
leave.
You haven't paid taxes
sir,
in 4 years.
Sir, I do.
Haven't paid taxes in 4 years.
Please
record profits.
Your business,
record
sir.
Profits. You collapse the economy and make record profits.
Business,
that's unacceptable.
Sir, do you have an account?
Second wave. Occupy DC marches to Bank of America, where 4 more accounts were closed.
Bank of America! Bank of America!
Loomis
gas truck. They had to bring in enough cash so people could close their accounts.
I have like 30 bucks in it. I'm going to move that shit right now.
Growing public support for the Occupy Wall Street protest movement speaks to the long simmering anger and frustration with the failures of the current economic system and the lack of accountability for the bankers and financiers whose reckless behavior wrecked the U.S. and world economy. In the U.S., recent polls find majority support for the protesters' central message condemning corporate greed and the corrupt political system rigged in favor of the interests of America's wealthiest 1%. While the U.S. corporate media is angry that it cannot yet get a specific list of the Occupy Wall Street activists' demands for change, there are many ideas for restructuring the U.S. financial and banking system that have been circulating for years that could offer viable solutions to repairing a broken system. Just as there was majority support to establish a public nonprofit alternative to private for-profit health insurance in the recent national health care reform debate, there is growing support for a government bank that offers competition to the nation's largest private banks that recklessly engaged in casino-like gambling and lost billions of dollars in their customers' investments. The public banking idea comes from the successful example of the 92-year-old Bank of North Dakota, the nation's only statewide publicly owned bank. Some observers credit North Dakota's public banking system for the state's low unemployment rate and large budget surpluses during the recent Great Recession. Your reporter spoke with Ellen Brown, an attorney and president of the Institute for Public Banking. Here she explains how North Dakota's public banking system works and how a similar system could be adopted by states nationwide.
North Dakota, our single public bank, was set up in 1919 under conditions quite like what we have today, where the farmers were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers. And when they discovered that the Wall Street banks were hooked to the railroads, were hooked to the granaries, so it was all one cartel. It was a Rockefeller cartel at that time. And they weren't actually taking their grain when it was good grain. So there was actually an effort to get these farms. And when they realized that, they banded together and formed a party called the Nonpartisan League. It was not about politics. It was not about socialism. In fact, North Dakota is a very Republican, conservative state. It was about state sovereignty, keeping their money in the state to serve their people. So the Bank of North Dakota was set up to basically do what the Federal Reserve does. It was sort of a central bank for the system. So it provides the liquidity for the little banks. It helps them with their capital requirements. It does not compete with the local banks. It partners with them. So they didn't get into this whole derivative mortgage-backed security type scheme because they didn't need to, because they had the backstop of the Bank of North Dakota. So they tend to keep the loans on their own books, and so these are local people. They follow them to make sure that they can pay, and it's a real partnership with the local economy and not one that's designed to exploit the local economy. So right now we have bills pending in 14 different states, either to form a state-owned bank or to do a feasibility study to see, you know, what it could do for the state.
Ellen, how would instituting a North Dakota-style public banking system in states around the country, how would that address many of the complaints and the resulting shattered economy we've seen from the reckless behavior of the for-profit banks?
Mm-hmm. Well, the number one thing it would do is to create jobs. The reason jobs are largely come through the small and medium-sized businesses, those same businesses that are funded by the public banks in Germany, and which is why they have such a strong manufacturing sector and export sector. It's the small and medium-sized local businesses that are not able to hire because they no longer have customers, and they don't have customers because the collapse of the mortgage situation and the whole credit collapse. And they can't get loans. They can't get cheap credit like they used to. In California, I've heard complaints. They used to be able to get 8% credit lines at their bank. And nothing has changed in their business. But suddenly, the banks are requiring them to use credit cards. So that's 16%. That doubles their interest rate. And all small companies run on credit, or even large companies, but they don't have trouble getting credit. But the small companies, you have to pay your workers and materials before you have a product. So if you can't get that credit line, then you don't dare expand your business and you don't dare hire more people. And a public banking setup will allow that. As in North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota partners with the local banks, and therefore they have lots of liquidity so they can make these local loans.
How much subsidies go to the North Dakota Bank from taxpayers?
No, the subsidies goes from the Bank of North Dakota to the taxpayers. Their profits go back to the state. Actually, they had a 19% return last year, I think. And before that, they had like a 26% return. They have a huge return on equity, and this is a major source of profits for the state. But the bank is not subsidized at all. I mean, how this bank works is that all of the state's revenues are deposited in the bank, but it is set up as a DBA of the state. So technically, all of the capital belongs to the bank as well. So it has no capital requirements. It has no deposit requirements. So then what it does with this huge amount of liquidity that it has is to spread it around and share it with the other banks.
Ellen, if you were to recommend a course of action state by state or on the federal level to institute public banking to provide funding for small businesses as an engine for the economy to boost employment and the economy as a whole, how would you go about it?
Well, I don't know that you do it on the federal level. And in fact, the reason we like the state-owned banks is that the federal level is pretty well locked up. They're deadlocked. They can't seem to make much progress in anything. But at the state level, you can still get in to see your legislators, and they'll listen to you. Here in California, we have a state bank bill that it just passed both houses of the legislature. Now, it wasn't signed by the governor, unfortunately, but there's still good momentum for our state bank movement. And that's just us. I mean, we're just volunteers on the ground who just generated interest and kept pushing until something happened here. And it really is a state thing. I mean, it's totally legal. Anybody can set up a bank who can qualify with the banking commissioner. I mean, Walmart could set up a bank if they wanted to. So there's no reason a state can't set up a bank. And it's just a matter of understanding what the principle here is. Banks actually literally create money. That's where our money comes from. They create money by leveraging their capital, and then they clear it through the deposits. So that power, the power to create bank credit, is what we want to get back into our local communities using our own local assets. We don't want to be giving away our capital and our revenues to Wall Street to use that leveraging power to be speculating abroad, speculating against us, buying up foreign companies that might compete with our companies, et cetera, all the things that Wall Street does, purporting to be doing it with their own money so, you know, they can do whatever they want. But they're not doing it with their own money. They're doing it with our money. So we want to bring our money back and use it for local purposes.
That was Ellen Brown, an attorney and president of the Institute for Public Banking. Her latest book is titled Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. Read more about the benefits of public banking on our website at btlonline.org.
On the 20th of October, Occupy DC wrapped up a day that had featured Stop the Machine occupying a Citibank, and Occupy DC disrupting operations at a Bank of America with a raid on a $1,000 a plate fundraiser at Union Station for a greenwashing fake ecology lobby called Conservation International, featuring the CEOs of both Walmart and Northrop Grumman. Union Station security didn't do anything about it. After half an hour, protesters withdrew and marched to the streets in triumph all the way back to McPherson Square.
Walmart's coming. Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something? Something. Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping. Cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping. Thumping. You can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave laborers. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market. Hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Uh-huh. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize. Yeah. Soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than the male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step 1, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart. It's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holler black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember DC doesn't work with the right-wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister. Strom Thurmond, similar. Confederate, state-loving George Bush ministers. Overseer plantation mentality. Results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs. And now they want to come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunist out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmarts in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
On the 20th of September, I received a robotic survey call from the Consumer Energy Alliance. They started with 2 questions, quote, do you believe gas prices are too high, and quote, do you believe unemployment is too high? Recognizing that this had to be a fake industry push poll, I answered no to both questions, even though Wall Street has indeed thrown far too many people out of work. I then managed to start recording the rest of this phony so-called survey, microphone to telephone. Turns out the whole survey is about pressuring the Department of State to approve that nasty tar sands oil pipeline that 1,250 people were arrested in front of the White House saying no to. Here's what my microphone got.
Reduce U.S. dependence on imports from the Middle East. To build this importing pipeline, TransCanada must receive a permit from the Department of State that will allow it to cross the border from Canada to the U.S. The Department of State is currently soliciting public comments on whether to grant the permit and allow TransCanada to build the pipeline and put thousands of Americans to work. May we have your permission to relay your support for this vital pipeline?
No, you may not. I oppose the pipeline and I wish the project would be blocked.
Please say yes, no.
No.
Repeat, now.
No.
Would you like more information on
no.
oil and gas production and the jobs that it can create?
No.
Are you male?
Yes.
Are you 50 years of age or older?
No.
Thank you for your time and views. This survey was conducted by the Consumer Energy Alliance. Goodbye. 7 Mark.
I should have gotten a recording more quickly.
It looks to me like the Consumer Energy Alliance is desperate to keep alive our bad romance with fossil fuels and dirty oil. No, I wasn't going to let them falsely tell the Department of State that I support the filthy Alberta tar sands mining. I'd rather see gasoline cost 10 bucks a gallon than support a pipeline whose contributions to global warming is going to flood every coastal city, including mine.
The U.S. House of Representatives just passed another in a series of anti-abortion bills that has been characterized by women's and civil liberties groups as one of the most extreme yet from the Republican-controlled body. The measure would allow hospitals to deny life-saving care to women in need of emergency abortion services. It would also deny women insurance coverage for abortion services under the new health care system, taking away insurance coverage that millions of women already have. According to the American Journal of Public Health, Catholic hospitals already have a history of ignoring their obligation to provide emergency care that may involve performing abortions. In 1979, an Arizona bishop excommunicated a nun who authorized an abortion procedure for a woman who otherwise might have died of pulmonary hypertension at a Catholic hospital in Phoenix. The main sponsor of the bill was Republican Congressman Joe Pitts from Pennsylvania, who was a co-sponsor of anti-abortion legislation known as the Stupak-Pitts Amendment to President Obama's health care reform legislation. Pitts' bill, H.R. 358, the Protect Life Act, passed in the House by a large majority, 251 to 172, and now goes to the Senate. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Sarah Lipton Lubit, policy counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. She describes what the bill would do and explains why the ACLU is involved in opposing the measure.
It's one in a line of anti-choice measures that the anti-choice leadership of the House has been pushing in really an unrelenting fashion this year. But this bill in particular is both unprecedented and unconscionable. It literally puts women's lives on the line in a way that we haven't seen before.
What are some examples of what would happen if this bill were to pass?
Current law requires that patients in medical emergencies receive appropriate medical treatment, which includes abortion care, if that's what is medically indicated for them. And this bill, the so-called Protect Life Act, although it actually threatens women's lives, would allow a hospital to ignore those essential emergency protections. So that means that a woman could show up in a hospital mid-emergency, right, her health and or her life under serious threat. The care that she needs is an emergency termination of her pregnancy. Her treating physician knows that's the care that she needs, wants to provide that care for her, and the hospital could say no.
Is this different from what Catholic hospitals do now?
This bill is designed to give license to those practices, which are currently not permitted.
And what do you think its chances are in the Senate?
We certainly hope that outrageous legislation like this wouldn't get a minute of time in the Senate. But it shouldn't have come to the House floor in the first place. It's insulting to women and to their families, and it would be almost unbelievable if the threat to women weren't so real.
Has Obama spoken out on this yet? I imagine he would veto it if it got to his desk.
The administration issued a veto threat.
Sarah Lipton Lubet, I first heard about this bill not from my usual sources like NARAL Pro-Choice America or the National Organization for Women or Planned Parenthood, but from the ACLU. How does abortion fit into ACLU's mission?
For decades, the ACLU has been centrally involved in the pro-choice movement. We've been involved in litigation in almost every case having to do with reproductive rights that's come before the Supreme Court, and we're actively involved in D.C. trying to protect the right to privacy that protects women's access to abortion care. And in particular, when it comes to institutions refusing to provide appropriate medical care or information on religious grounds. You know, about a year ago, you may recall the story of a woman in Arizona, a mother of several children, who had a life-threatening condition, was at a Catholicly affiliated hospital. The ethics board there permitted her to have the abortion care that she needed to protect her life. And as a result of that, the staff that signed that approval was demoted and the hospital lost its Catholic status. Well, that was a story that got some national attention. And in the wake of that, the ACLU reached out to the Department of Health and Human Services to file a complaint and say, you know, Department of Health and Human Services, you need to make sure that hospitals are informed of their obligations under emergency care laws, such as the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. You need to make sure that hospitals are following these protections and giving women the care that they need.
There's another major problem with this legislation regarding insurance coverage for abortion. It seems like it's the reappearance of the infamous Stupak Amendment that was defeated before Obama's health care reform passed.
in addition to creating this dangerous loophole in emergency protection laws, this bill would effectively eliminate insurance coverage for abortion in plans sold on the new marketplaces created by healthcare reform. Most private insurance plans already cover abortion care. It's the standard of care. And this would result in depriving millions of women of the coverage that they already have.
That was Sarah Lipton Lubit, policy counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. For more information on pending anti-abortion legislation, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.